to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
The next day, ring, ring, it's Milton Friedman on the telephone from Stanford University, and he had a bigger perspective on the whole problem than I did. I was still in end the Fed mode would be the solution to the problem, and it's not. It's not the Fed that's the problem. It's the power of the banking community hidden behind the Fed that is the problem. And until we address that by taking away their ability to control totally the quantity of money in this country, we will have done nothing, and all of our efforts will eventually go for naught.
That's the venerable Fed documentarian, journalist, writer, and former presidential candidate Bill Still talking about the time he got a call from famed economist Milton Friedman and the warning that Friedman delivered to him. Bill Still is our guest today, and his conversation with Ellen will cover the necessity of taking away the right to create money from public bankers. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute, with a focus this week on how the consolidation of capital in the hands of global finance is gradually, but ever more quickly, taking over virtually everything. Now, in the past few days, we've seen that demonstrated dramatically in a rather frightening way with the emergence of the text of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty, all 5,544 pages of it, which at last provides us a look into how far these monopolistic corporate interests will go in rolling over the rights, laws, sovereignty, and interests of the people. Writer Chris Hedges calls them sociopaths. And when you hear Dr. Margaret Flowers talk about what's in these so-called treaties, you might agree with him. Margaret will give you the essential update of what this treaty includes and how we lowly citizens must take action to stop this threat. First, let's check in with what Ellen is focusing on in this world of money madness.
What I'm actually writing about is that Sweden is leading the charge in negative interest rates and the cashless society. In other words, everybody has to use the banks, and the banks are going to charge us for holding our deposits. I mean, they haven't done it yet. So far, it's just the central bank charging the local banks for holding their reserves, but they will have to pass those costs on, no doubt, to the depositors. And then to keep the depositors from pulling their money out, they don't really have that choice because they're going all digital. And, you know, all over Europe, they're making it harder and harder to pull money out, to pull big money out. But you've got to keep a bunch of $1 bills around, I guess.
Wow.
Well, so what I'm writing about is that, I mean, it just shows the idiocy of conventional theory. If you believe that that's why they're doing it, that might just be an excuse. But the theory is that central banks have always used the interest rate, you know, as their chief tool for regulating the amount of money in the system. So the idea is that if you raise rates, it'll make it harder for people to borrow, and borrowing is how money enters the system. So they won't borrow as much, and therefore you can reduce the money supply, you know, if you got inflation on your hands. And if you've got deflation, then you would lower interest rates and make it easier for people to borrow. But they're already down to zero, and it hasn't worked. So their solution is to go below zero, which is, you know, it just shows that the theory is wrong. What's the reason people aren't spending is not because the interest rate is too high for them to borrow. It's because the money is just not there in the system. They're not getting paid. Their money is going to pay down their existing debts. You know, people don't have the money, so what you have to do is get that money out there. So you have to get the money out there first, which means a national dividend, I would say, or some other form of hiring people, like infrastructure, using quantitative easing for infrastructure, perhaps.
So we talked with Margaret Flowers from Flush the TPP and find ourselves again back into this mode of frantically scrambling to get people power to stop something that Bill Still said in your interview is virtually the end of the line. You know, it's like if we don't stop this corporate coup of the TPP, what power will we have left at all to impact this? Do you concur with that?
Yeah, I agree.
So, Ellen, the release in the last couple of days of this almost 6,000-page text of the Trans-Pacific Partnership has elicited a tremendous amount of doomsday sort of prospects a summary sort of judgments that this kind of the end of the line. Chris Hedges quotes Ralph Nader. He says that the TPP, along with the World Trade Organization and NAFTA, you know, the North American Free Trade Agreement, is the most brazen corporate power grab in American history. This is Ralph Nader talking to Chris Hedges. Nader continued to say it allows corporations to bypass all three branches of our government and to impose enforceable sanctions by secret tribunals. These tribunals can declare our labor, consumer, and environmental protections unlawful, non-tariff barriers subject to fines for non-compliance. It establishes a transnational autocratic system of enforceable governance in defiance of our domestic laws. That's quoting Ralph Nader, quoting Chris Hedges. Is that how you see it also? How is that going to affect our monetary prospects and realities?
Yeah, totally. Essentially, it will be robbing us of a government that looks out for our interests, because anything that impedes the profits of the corporations, they can sue us over. So legislators are not going to do anything that might get them sued for stepping on somebody's toes. But why? Why should corporate profits be above the interests of the people and the environment and, you know, fairness and equality and all those things that the U.S. is supposed to be about and that every country is about, you know, protecting the rights of the people? Why are the rights of corporations superior to the rights of people? You have these tribunals where corporations can sue governments, but governments cannot sue the corporations. What, it's so Alice in Wonderland. I mean, it's unbelievable that they could pull this off, and yet they have pulled this off. Why? Because they have the money, so they can bribe or whatever. They can get politicians to vote their way. They can shape the media so that most people aren't aware of what a huge threat it is. We, the little people, can only do stuff like march in the streets, which don't manage to get on the news. It's the major media that reach most of the people, and they are not going to say what the real hazard is. They will say, oh, it's all about free trade, and it's good for us because it will allow us to sell our products in other countries. But it works the other way as well. It allows other countries to suck up all the good jobs and to sell their products here, you know, without tariffs. So, it's really quite alarming. And if you're looking at public banks, how are we going to get a public bank set up when they will say that's unfair competition? I mean, the whole idea that you should be, that it's all about unfair competition, I thought that free markets determine competition, you know. Anyway, they don't need tribunals where you can where you can go in and sue somebody for taking some of your profits. Why is it not unfair competition that the big Wall Street banks are squeezing out the little banks? I mean, they obviously have the protection of the government, whereas the little banks don't. They have, they get bailed out for one thing, and now they have the privilege of bailing in our deposits if they need to. The little banks don't do that. It's only the systemically essential banks. So why is that not unfair competition or any big monopoly? I mean, we have so many, like Monsanto, for example. Why is that not unfair competition, that their seeds come onto the little farmer's land and the little farmer can get sued for having these seeds on his land, which didn't even, you know, they blew onto his land. I mean, why is that considered something protectable in the courts, whereas the little guy whose natural seeds are getting squeezed out by these horrible growths does not have standing to sue? I mean, the law has been warped. Everything has been warped in favor of the big corporations. It's a cancer that has taken over society. My guest today is widely acclaimed documentary film producer Bill Still. Bill is a former newspaper editor and publisher who has written for USA Today, the Saturday Evening Post, and the Los Angeles Times, among other outlets. He has also written over 20 books and has produced 3 documentary videos, The Money Masters, The Secret of Oz, and Jekyll Island, The Truth Behind the Federal Reserve. The Secret of Oz won the Best Documentary Award at the 2010 Beloit International Film Festival. So, Bill, it's great to be speaking with you.
Yeah, thanks. And nice to talk to you again, Ellen.
So we'll be speaking together on November 17th at an American Freedom Alliance event in Los Angeles on how to eliminate the federal debt. And in fact, that was the subject of your latest book, which is called No More National Debt. So what's your proposal for eliminating the debt?
Well, basically, as the bonded indebtedness that the federal debt is made up, the national debt is made up of, as the bonds come due, you just pay them off, but instead of using Federal Reserve notes or their electronic equivalents, you use old U.S. notes, Abraham Lincoln's greenbackers, to pay them off. The majority of the federal debt is on a short-term basis. So, in other words, after about 3 years, you'd have about half the debt paid off, and that's really the only way to do it. You hear politicians talk about all the time, oh, gee, we need to pay down the federal debt. And, of course, they're talking about paying down the federal debt with Federal Reserve notes or their electronic equivalents. And that's just not going to work because, unfortunately, we are in a debt money economy. That is, all debts, except for the coins that are produced in this country, are produced as interest-bearing debts. And so if you were to eliminate that debt, you would be eliminating the money of the nation. And can you imagine a situation where the money supply of the United States actually went down significantly at this point? It would be a total disaster. So there's really only one way to do it in general. There are probably some, you have other variants of this, but that's to pay down the debt as it comes due using U.S. notes or their electronic equivalents.
Mm-hmm. Right, and of course, I totally agree with that. Or they could use quantitative easing and just void it out, or they could do a few trillion-dollar coins and just put them in the account at the Federal Reserve or the Treasury and then just write checks on that and pay it off. So the objection we always get is that this would be hyperinflationary. So do you have a good response to that? I have a response, but go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sure you do, and I'll be interested to hear that. But, yeah, I was just thinking about that yesterday as we're coming up on this November 17th date, and I suddenly got a real good brainstorm. And, of course, to use the term quantitative easing really puts a bad taste in people's mouths, and for good reason, because it was quantitative easing essentially for the 1% of the banking class. That's where this money all went to. And, of course, it caused some inflation in that area, in the area that the 1% trades in. However, it didn't do much for the 99%, the rest of us. So if you're talking about quantitative easing, then, you kind of need to specify that this is a different kind of quantitative easing. And so I don't think there'd be I don't think it would be inflationary because people are hurting right now. They're deeply in debt. And for example, just think about your own condition. If you were suddenly given enough money, enough cash, or let's say some kind of coupons where you could pay off half of your own debts tomorrow. Would that mean that you would immediately run out and buy the latest, greatest TV set and a brand new Mercedes-Benz? No, probably not. But it would greatly improve your financial position if you weren't absolutely struggling to make every car payment or every house payment. And so I think the economy has plenty of extra room, plenty of slack, that's probably measurable in the productive economy or something like that, so that we could take an awful lot of this quantitative easing for the masses before it would start to create seriously an increase in inflation. And once again, would you run out and buy more milk, bread, or cookies or whatever? No, because you're already spending that money because those are the necessities of life. I'm not saying that cookies are the necessity of life. That was an ill choice of wording. But so that would be my response, and I'd like to hear what yours would be.
Yeah, well, similar. We're talking about bonds, people who hold bonds largely, for example, pension funds or brokers or whatever. I mean, there are a lot of people hold bonds, but generally you wouldn't have your money in bonds if you didn't want to save it. I mean, it was there in the first place because you weren't going to rush out and spend it. So one way they could pay off the debt is as they did one time in 2004. I wrote an old article about this, like I think in 2007. It was kind of shocking at the time that there was a 2004 bond issue that the government said, well, the interest rate is too high. It was like 9.75%. So the government said, well, we're going to call that bond. And what happened was it would all happen in their Treasury Direct account. So before, you would have X amount of money in bonds in that account, and after they called it, you would have X amount of money in cash in that account. So it was totally an accounting function. You didn't even have to switch to U.S. notes or whatever. They just paid it off. And then, of course, they always feel compelled to reissue those bonds, but you could just forget about reissuing it and just pay it off because they are the government and they have the power to create money. So create it digitally and pay it off. And of course, I mean, it seems to me that's happened to me before, like where you have a bond or something, or, you know, things change in your account. It changes from one form to another. Like maybe it's, say you sell a stock. You first had X amount of money in stock, and then the next day you have X amount of money in dollars. It doesn't do anything to your propensity to go out and spend. You'll just look around for some other investment for it, or maybe just leave it in cash. I mean, these days, cash is looking pretty good. It's probably the safest thing around. Even, in fact, banks are very unsafe these days. There's not much that's really safe except cash. So I agree. It would not affect consumer spending. I think it wouldn't affect consumer spending at all. And it wouldn't actually affect the money supply because those bonds are money. I mean, they're a form of money. They're called near money. But in many, globally, they trade bonds just as if they were money. They don't even bother to cash them out. So the inflation, if it was going to happen, happened when they took out the bond in the first place, when they took out a loan. Just like when you go to the bank and you take out a loan, the bank creates that money in your account. So that's when the money supply increases, and that's why the money supply includes checkbook money, which is the vast majority of the money supply. Well, that was just created on the books of the banks. Well, similarly, when the government takes out a loan, they go out and spend the money, whereas before you, the lender, were just going to let it sit in your account. So that's when the inflation occurs, if it's going to occur. So it's already occurred. So, yep, that would be my answer, too.
There's a deep well, I think, also that I certainly have not thought of before, and maybe you have, in the American economy. For example, if you were given by some entrepreneur foundation $1 million and said, okay, Ellen, we want you to use this money to pursue the work of monetary reform, well, that would allow you to do a lot of things that you were not able to do previously, and those things would not include going out and buying the latest car, but it would allow you to throw that money into productive pursuits. I'm not interested in providing more cash for freebies. I'm interested in increasing the productive, you know, an incentive-driven economy, increasing the productive value. And that doesn't, I don't think, necessarily increase the inflationary value. So that's why I think the economy has a deep need for additional money. And if we provide that money, I think it'll just make the American economy much stronger and not hyperinflationary.
Right. Even if you pay off the debt, it's still up to Congress to vote on a budget. I mean, the fact that they are no longer in debt just means they don't have to pay $450 billion a year in interest on this loan, so they have more money to spend, but they still have to approve the budget. And as long as they're, like you say, not going out and buying fine cars for all of the congressmen, it's not going to affect the consumer spending. What it will affect, if anything, is that we'll get some infrastructure built, and those services that we think we don't have enough money for, et cetera. Yep, agreed.
Right. It might inflate the price of concrete, and it might inflate the wages of the folks who are going to be building that infrastructure. But that's all for the good anyway.
Right.
And I don't see this terrible problem. But I do think it's important to link with any sort of paying off the national debt the absolute law, and of course that would take an amendment to the Constitution, that the government not be allowed to borrow any more again for any purpose. Why would a nation borrow when a nation can't create? I mean, it's just madness. Number one, we have to pay interest on the debt, but much, much more tragically is the borrower becomes servant to the lender. And so it doesn't take long at all before the banking class, the ones doing the lending, doing the purchasing of this national debt, of these bonds, before the banking class ends up controlling the political class, which is what we see today. And that's why people are so angry by the current political situation, or the anger is being demonstrated. They know that the ship of state no longer responds to their commands. And it just goes on by some other invisible hand, and they're angry about that. And, of course, that invisible hand is the banking class that now is controlling the political class, namely Congress, through this form of bribery called lobbying. And it's outrageous, and eventually we're going to wake up and figure out what the root of the problem is. And you and I already understand this, and we just cannot possibly fix the problem until we fix the money problem.
Right. Well, interestingly, we do have two candidates that are not beholden to big money, and that's Donald Trump, who's got his own money, and Bernie Sanders, who just won't take it. So I'm wondering, I mean, I'm sure you don't have any insights into this, but I wonder if either of them would actually be so bold as to pay off the debt, or at least, like you say, pay it down as the bonds come due, or what, you know, do something radical in the money field.
I also think Dr. Carson is in that loop, because his money isn't necessarily coming in big chunks, but he's a traditional small funder type of candidate. And I think any of those three would certainly be most likely to understand this. And I think Trump is probably the one who is most likely to understand what the solution is, because he probably has the biggest picture view of the economic situation. And you remember, in I think the very first debate, where he said, you know, these bankers, they're not babies. You know, they're criminals. They're vicious. And that's exactly right. So Trump must understand what it is like at the highest levels of the banking community.
Yeah, that's a very good point, because I think one reason that politicians are afraid to do these bold measures is they actually feel they need the banks or whatever. But if they had the political will, they could do it. So like you say, if Trump understands that these are criminals and we need to get rid of them, he could do something radical, just like Roosevelt did. You know, once they make up their mind to do it, they can do it. Or even World War II, they didn't have the money to fight World War II, and it just appeared. It came from somewhere. They can find the money when they need to.
Yes, but, you know, that right now, all the other politicians, the financial community has their hands around their throat, because that's where most of these donations come through, one way or another, through either financial institutions or the corporations who are in debt to the financial institutions. It's becoming very clear that that's the case now, and it's certainly the case with the major media. I know for a fact the president of one of the three alphabet networks told me for a fact that it's J.P. Morgan that controls the three major networks, through lending. They have them in debt up to their eyeballs right now, to where they can't even afford to pay the interest on that debt. So for the networks to survive, they have to roll the debt over completely. And J.P. Morgan is the one that owns the debt and is rolling over the debt. And those networks know never, ever, ever to cross J.P. Morgan. And so how can we have a free exchange of ideas if literally the major electronic media are owned, essentially, by the biggest banks?
But that's why I think it's cool that they can't seem to control Donald Trump, and Bernie Sanders also speaks his mind. So we have a sort of populist movement going on, which brings up your video that I'm most familiar with because I was actually in it, which was The Secret of Oz, which was a populist movement in the 1890s, and we seem to be going back to that. I mean, it's come around, and that they've gone through all these other exercises which didn't work, and I think people can now see that the big banks failed, that regulation hasn't worked. It's time for something else, something that will serve the people. Do you want to talk a bit about your movie?
Yeah, well, it's as you know, it's the exact same issue, which is why I decided to do the film and why you decided to participate. It's just the exact same issue that's coming to the fore once again. And I think the American population back in 1900, when L. Frank Baum wrote The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, the book version, they were deeply immersed in this issue. That bankers were essentially controlling the financial economy and thereby the political economy of the nation as well. And I think the American electorate in general was much more literate on this issue in 1900 than we are today. Today, they've thrown up a bunch of straw men and rabbit trails to confuse people, perpetually confused. And those, the two that I like to pound on the hardest are the gold standard, the gold bug. So if we'd only return to gold, then everything would be just fine. And of course, that's nonsense. Even if gold were practical, gold is what's known as expensive money as opposed to cheap money. And gold will only keep the financial power much more concentrated. It will not democratize the financial powers, which is what we need today. It's the same issue 120 years ago that it was today. And like you say, we've tried the other alternatives, namely massive regulation in the form of the Fed. And it turns out that the Fed really doesn't control the banks at all. We found out during the 2008 congressional investigations that instead of maintaining a 9 or 10 to 1 reserve ratio, the biggest banks in New York were leveraged 52 to 1, 80 to 1, or in one case, 333 to 1. So they don't care about the Fed's regulations. They do whatever they want. And the Fed is just kind of the curtain to make us hiding the power of the wizard, making us think that somebody connected to the government is controlling the banks, when in fact that's not the case. The Fed is a creature of the banks. It's a private corporation wholly owned only by the banks. And so you can never have a corporation that doesn't serve its owners. So the Fed serves the banks, not the banks serving the Fed.
Yeah, and I think people are more and more realizing that. I mean, they're not the wizard behind the curtain that they once were. At least people that we know or people that listen to this show are certainly savvy on the Federal Reserve, and that way you were a groundbreaker on that with your first video, The Money Masters, in 1999. That was quite early, and you had a ton of information in there. I wondered if you wanted to talk about, you know, how you got into that. I saw that Milton Friedman was one of your editors or advisors. What brought you to that subject and that wealth of information?
Well, first of all, I just remembered the other rabbit trails that I forgot a minute ago, so I just want to touch on them. That's the End the Fed movement and the Audit the Fed movement. We could spend many years pursuing those rabbit trails and may yet still be forced to do that, but that's really not the problem. Even if you were to end the Fed tomorrow, you know, we audited the Fed, found out, oh, they were bad boys, so now we're going to kill them, and so we ended the Fed the next day. And then Monday comes, and would that prevent the banks? Would the banks still be giving out mortgage loans? No, of course they would. They'd be giving out mortgage loans based on absolutely nothing, money that they got to create at the instant that loan was created. That's what the problem is. It's not what backs the money that's important. It's who controls its quantity. And right now, the banks completely control the quantity instead of somehow, some way, we the people of the United States controlling the quantity. And that is what the essential problem is. As far as the Money Masters goes, I contacted Dr. Friedman after we had the first cut of the Money Masters, and I've been a reporter all my life. I knew how to contact academics. You just call up the press office and say, I want to talk to Dr. Friedman. I've got this documentary and something that he'd be interested in. Well, the next day, ring, ring, it's Milton Friedman on the telephone from Stanford University, and he was very gracious and said, yeah, send it to me, and I'll look at it over the weekend, and he did, and he called up on Monday morning, and I'll never forget his first words. He was kind of a grouchy old guy at that point, but he was very helpful, he said, boy, if you kill the Fed and don't do anything about fractional reserve lending, you've done nothing, and he had a bigger perspective on the whole problem than I did. I was still in end the Fed mode would be the solution to the problem, and it's not. So we had to re-edit the Money Masters and jiggled it around a little bit to show that it's not the Fed that's the problem. It's the power of the banking community hidden behind the Fed that is the problem. And until we address that, by taking away their ability to control totally the quantity of money in this country, we will have done nothing, and all of our efforts will eventually go for naught.
Yep. Well, good work on that. I certainly enjoyed it. It was a long movie, 3 hours, but I watched it when I was in England years ago, and it was very, very revelatory, I thought. Your third documentary was called Jekyll Island, The Truth Behind the Federal Reserve. That's the most recent one. So people do know quite a bit about the Federal Reserve now, but I'm sure you learned things making that video that even you didn't know, so I wondered if you might just... if a couple of things come to mind that were really kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah, the thing that comes to mind is I really figured out to a much greater degree the practical step that we have to take, which is to break the connection between the political class and the banking class. And the way that happened was I was in Israel. The Monetary Reform Group over there brought me over, and the first talk I gave, a representative of a big lawyer came up afterwards and said, Mr. Such and Such wants to talk to you. And I said, okay. And anyway, we didn't get to talk that evening, but we set up to meet at a mutual friend's house the next day at kind of a party situation. And he explained to me how the banking class manipulates the parliament in Israel. And it's through these short-term, what he calls call notes, that can be called in either 30, 60, or 90 days. And there are, I guess, 8 major political parties in Israel, and they have all of those parties indebted to a degree greater than their net worth. So that by merely calling in a small percentage of these loans at any time, they can bankrupt any political party. And he said this is how the banks maintain absolute control over the political system in Israel, because if they don't like a piece of legislation that's been introduced, they call the head of the party that's introducing this piece of legislation into the bank, and they read them the Riot Act. Essentially, we can bankrupt your party. In fact, some of the major parties, even the party leader, they have him indebted to personally to the bank. To a greater degree than his net worth, so they can totally bankrupt him. So it's a very simple. It's a scam, and they just use money and debt to get what they want. And so that guy's on film, and I got that guy on camera saying this stuff. And the reason he knows is he was the lawyer who was the mediator between the banks and the political parties. And he withdrew from them, and they got into a bunch of lawsuits back and forth, and he's still fighting them. He's still alive, too, surprisingly.
But in any case, that really opened my eyes as to the extent of their control and the specific way they do it. And then, you know, now as I go down, I'm always figuring out something as I go down this journey. And now you see it, that's why people are talking about K Street, the problem with the lobbyists. And the lobbyists are not just small guys. The lobbyists are all, many of them, they're representing the financial community in one way or another. And it's very, very clear they bought these votes, for example, to get Fast Track through. I think they paid John Boehner over $5 million to usher Fast Track through. And as you know, now that the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is out and about to go up for a final vote, it's going to be very difficult for the U.S. Senate to not vote it through, which is going to absolutely end national sovereignty. And the sovereignty of the nation state on the international level is so important because it is the separation of powers concept on the international level that the founding fathers of the United States saw that was so essential to keeping our national power from becoming dictatorial. So it's absolutely true that the power of the sovereign nation state is absolutely essential in keeping the world relatively free. And this is what the TPP and the European Union in Europe try to do. They try to obliterate national sovereignty. And so we have something that we can do right here, right now, and that's to get our Congress, I mean, this week, next week, sometime before the end of the year, to rescind the fast-track legislation that they passed the last week in June. Because if fast-track stays, then eventually we're going to have the TPP voted through. And you should read what Jeff Sessions said yesterday about the TPP bill. It just obliterates national sovereignty. It makes the United States subservient to unelected bureaucrats, faceless unelected bureaucrats, and so we'll really have no way out from that point on.
Yeah, I agree. It's an alarming thing. And that's, like you say, it's a simple mechanism. They've been doing it. That's what they did in the 19th century, was just call in loans, and then the farmers wouldn't be able to pay. They'd foreclose on the farms, and they gobbled up all the property, and they're still doing it. Yeah, it's quite alarming, and we are in a fix. I guess all we can do is keep writing and talking and making videos.
Yeah, it's a selfless work that you and I are doing and a few other people around
you
the world.
You could say hopeless.
There's absolutely no money in monetary reform, and so this is our giant contribution to the health of our nation and even the health of the world in trying to rid it of the monster that is about to choke the life out of any concept of democracy or we the people or rule of, by, and for the people worldwide. And we're getting really close to the point where we're not going to be able to successfully fight it anymore. So it's important work, and, you know, we're just slaving away in the trenches of monetary reform, hoping somebody's going to come up and help pay the bill at some point.
They're hoping we can mobilize the 99%. We've obviously got the numbers, but we're not together. So if we could get people behind a major movement, we might get some action.
Which is what's so destructive about this end the Fed, audit the Fed movement, combined with the no, we need to, the answer is the gold-backed currency. And so it just keeps people confused.
Yeah, agreed. Anyway, thank you for your labor in this venture. I've learned a lot from your work. It's been great talking to you, and I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say on November 17th. So that event is at the Lux Hotel in Bel Air in Los Angeles at 7:30 p.m. And if our listeners want more information, they can go to the American Freedom Alliance website. Do you have any other websites or places you want to point people to?
Well, my website is billstill.com. You can find a list of all my videos. I have an extensive YouTube channel with over 600 YouTubes put up on there, and trying to cover all the bases in the monetary reform world.
It's been great talking to you. I've been speaking with Bill Still, author of No More National Debt, among many other books, and producer of three documentary videos, including The Money Masters and The Secret of Oz.
Now we turn to look at the contents and implications of the newly released Trans-Pacific Partnership, an important bit of business that you possibly would rather not hear about, but better know about. Dr. Margaret Flowers, one of the primary drivers of public resistance against the TPP through the group FlushTheTPP.org, told us what's in this mysterious and complicated deal.
After 5 years of secret negotiation in which they classified the text, they just released the content of the text. And so a number of organizations have been scrambling to release their analyses. But what we've seen so far from this 2,000 pages of very highly technical legal language that was written by major corporations like Monsanto and Exxon and Pfizer is that it confirms our concerns that this is really an agreement that puts corporate power over the power of even our own governments to protect our communities, that it drives privatization of really everything, even things that we need for our basic necessities, and allows corporations the power to sue our country if our laws interfere with their expected profits. So this is really something that has very wide-reaching impact, from everything to the safety of the food that we eat, our ability to have access to clean water. It drives more extraction of extreme energy through fracking and those kinds of things, raises healthcare costs. I could go on and on, but it really impacts everything that we care about.
It's amazing that there's any support for it at all, having it described in that way. Where's the support coming from at the congressional level? Or is that obvious?
Well, this is why they kept it secret. And even the prior U.S. Trade Representative, Ron Kirk, said after he left that position that if the people knew what was in it, we'd never be able to get it passed. So just as, we know, we even have academic studies now that show that our government is a government that represents the interests of the wealthy and not the interests of people. This is an agreement that was written by those corporate interests, and they're the ones who fund the campaigns of the members of Congress. And so, it's the same kind of situation that we've seen over and over again, where these corporate interests hold the power, that money power, over our members of Congress to, coerce them into supporting it. And a few members of Congress have been standing up and speaking out against it, which is important. We need more of them to do that.
I think that many people are surprised that President Obama has been such a strong supporter of this. How do you tie his language of support for people's interests, healthcare, et cetera, in? How do you make sense of that?
Well, this has been typical, really, of his campaign, and it's interesting because Obama was the one that picked up the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It had been dead. It wasn't being negotiated, and he, brought it. And actually, the leaks that we've seen throughout the five-year process through WikiLeaks show us that the United States has been the most aggressive negotiator, driving for the most corporate power, pushing other countries beyond their comfort zone in this. And in fact, senators like Senator Orrin Hatch says that we gave away too much when it comes to things like protecting the profits of pharmaceutical companies. I mean, I can't speak to Obama's motivations. I think this has been really much, pretty much in line with the way that he's done his whole presidency. He's very much in favor of this kind of neoliberal economic model that pushes disinvestment in public services and drives more privatization.
So from our perspective of people who are interested in creating new publicly owned public interest banks, how do you perceive this TPP language as constraining that?
I think people who support public banks should be very concerned about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the other agreements that are coming down the line, the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership, and specifically the Trade and Services Agreement. What we've seen and is that this is a direct attack on our ability to have institutions that are designed to protect the public good. So there's language in the TPP that says that things that are considered to be a state-owned enterprise, that's their language, but it really means anything that has any kind of public advantage to it, like a public bank, would be seen as a threat to the private entities. And so they would require that we level the playing field between our public institutions and our private institutions. And so that will really make it place a huge obstacle towards being able to create public banks.
So it's codifying the privatization model over the public model universally, it seems, doesn't it?
That's an excellent way to put it. And I mean, even we just, I was looking at a case today where, you know, water, a private corporation is suing Canada because they banned export of water because they needed that water for themselves. I mean, these are the kinds of things, the battles that we're going to see increasingly in the future under these types of agreements if they pass.
Wow. What then are we to do as citizens? What's on the list?
Well, the good news is that we've stopped threatening agreements before, like the Free Trade Area of the Americas and the Multilateral Agreement on Investments, and that came from really people making the political culture too toxic for our politicians to be able to support these agreements. And that's something that's been developing also over these past number of years. This really great movement of movements has been coming together in the United States with all sorts of organizations working together. And we held Congress off from giving the president something called Fast Track, which he needed. We held that off for years and years, and they just barely squeaked by. So we need to continue to build that. And we're doing that this fall, actually in just 10 days. We're doing a mobilization in Washington, D.C. People are coming together for 2 days of training and 3 days of actions to really build that kind of street pressure to raise awareness and, you know, make it more unpopular for Congress. And that's something we're going to have to continue to build on. It really is going to take all of us working together to educate ourselves, educate others in our communities, put pressure on our members of Congress, be willing to come out when protests are organized, and really continue to escalate this pressure throughout the next year so we can hold this off. And we have a campaign website called flushthetpp.org, and that is specifically designed to give people the tools to protest this or resist it. So it has educational tools so you can learn more about it. It has media tools so you can learn how to spread the word. It has an action map for people that want to find an action or organize one. So we really encourage people to go to Flush the TPP and get involved in this fight.
So we encourage people to be in conversation with their local representatives, the city councils, the mayors, the state reps, and so forth, because that seems to be where democracy still has some chance of influencing outcomes. Does this discussion have really essentially local components of it that could be raised in a public hearing for the city council? You know, why should the city council be concerned about the international trade agreement?
Absolutely. This is something that will directly impact all of our lives through limiting our access to healthy food, raising the costs of health care. It even has a provision, if you can believe it, to ban Buy America. So we can't give higher priorities to products that are made here. We have to allow equal access to products that are made outside of our country. There is a really great effort going on around the country called TPP Free Zones. They're being promoted over the past few years by the Alliance for Democracy, and they have a website, tppfreezones.org. And this is where communities are passing resolutions to say that this deal was negotiated in secret and passed, you know, without our consent, and it will prevent us from protecting the health and safety of our communities. We are not going to comply with that. We're going to continue to stand up for our community. So this is another very important component of the resistance, and I encourage people to check that out, tppfreezones.org. There are materials provided there to help you have those conversations with your council members.
That's great. Now, Margaret, has the Fast Track Authority ever been confronted on constitutional grounds as being against the constitutional obligation of the people having a say in treaties like this?
You know, unfortunately, we don't, as far as we can tell, have the legal standing to be able to challenge the Fast Track process. What we've been told is that we have to wait until after something like the Trans-Pacific Partnership has been passed, and then there's a specific case, and then we can challenge the constitutionality of that. So, unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be a tool at our disposal right now, although there are legal scholars who have said that these agreements, because they supersede our national law and even create an court system outside of our court system that we that supersedes our own Supreme Court. We would think that this would be, you know, a no-brainer, that this is not constitutional, but that's the way the system works right now.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so that time-wise, now that it's out, there's several months for the Congress to sit with it, and then there's an up or down vote, no amendments, anything, right?
That's right. So what's kicked off right now is a 60-day period, which the public has access to the text, and people are looking at that closely right now. Then there are several other steps that need to be taken in terms of the president can then sign it after those 60 days, but then they have to, Congress has to pass what's called the implementing legislation. They have to put together a whole piece of legislation that describes how this will change our laws. Because one thing that we don't talk about enough is that basically, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is rewriting our laws. So we have to become in compliance with that. Your listeners may be familiar with the World Trade Organization that was passed and created in the mid-90s, which required the repeal of Glass-Steagall, that wall of protection between banks and investments that was partly responsible for our 2008 financial crisis. So that had to be repealed to be in compliance with the WTO.
Are you saying that we were just complying with the WTO?
It was to be part of the WTO. We had to be in compliance. We had to repeal Glass-Steagall. Yeah.
Wow. Well, interesting times, challenging. Enough to keep you awake, huh?
Well, and to get us galvanized, we can win this. So I think this is a critical turning point to us where we can come together and say no more to this model of kind of global trade and governance that we have decades now of evidence that show that this model fails to protect our communities and that we need to demand a new type of model that puts the needs of people and protection of the planet before corporate profit.
That was Dr. Margaret Flowers, a co-director of the group Popular Resistance. Get in touch with the grassroots movement against the TPP by visiting her website at flushthetpp.org.
Imagine a world where all values, all human and non-human interests, all endeavors and hopes have been reduced to profits and losses in some aloof accountant's spreadsheet, where the misery of poverty is merely a cost of doing business, and the suffering economically insecure human beings a disposable externality. I'm Matt Stannard with the Public Banking Report, and for a long time, that was an image of the world of the Trans-Pacific Partnership I tried hard to imagine was not the case. Obama and other TPP proponents have long insisted that the agreement would be the most progressive, pro-labor, pro-environment, just trade agreement in history. But there's simply no evidence to suggest that. The framework and enforcement mechanisms of the TPP greatly privilege investors and corporations. The concrete examples of this privileging are deeply disturbing. National Nurses United points out that Obama lied about price controls on life-saving medicines, where the administration initially promised to reduce monopoly pricing rules from 12 years with pricing monopolies to 5 years. These rules are littered with loopholes, allowing inflated prices for up to 8 years or longer, while people die without access to medication. Those patent exclusivity rules undermine nations' abilities to create generic, cheaper versions of the drugs. This monopoly control, according to National Nurses United Director Roseanne DeMarco, could be a death sentence for countless patients. And just to be clear, she calls the TPP's pharmaceutical rules a cruel and disgraceful threat to millions of lives. As it is with drugs, so it is with financial services. The TPP contains, as mechanisms of dispute resolution, investor-state dispute settlement provisions, allowing corporations and investors to challenge domestic financial services, democratically made financial regulations, public sector services. The decisions of the trade tribunals would then levy fines on countries whose policies and domestic institutions were found to be unfairly disadvantageous to private investors. Many nations would simply eliminate those programs to avoid the controversy in the first place. This would affect virtually all government endeavors to reduce inequality, limit Wall Street abuses, and institute public options in banking, insurance, and other services. If you doubt this, take a look at what the U.S. has done already to Japan's postal banking system before the ink was even dry on the TPP. According to the Washington Post, the Obama administration has negotiated limits through the TPP on what post offices can do in financial spaces. In this case, Japan Postal Bank offers a public option for insurance. The TPP complaint forces Japan to curtail what the private insurance industry calls an unfair advantage. Similar complaints could list postal banks as a whole as unfair players, public banks as well. Any endeavor that provides more reasonable and accessible services than the private sector could fall within the target of investor dispute settlement. And it's here where a major difference in philosophy, in worldview, emerges between TPP defenders and the millions of working people opposed to the deal. Apologists for the TPP are neoliberals. Neoliberalism holds that everything should be privatized, all public services gutted and sold. In the neoliberal worldview, public service is potentially anti-competitive because the whole damn point of public service is accessibility. Providing services to poor and working people isn't always market competitive. That's why we have public utilities. Neoliberal ideology is trickle-down economics. It assumes that free trade eventually pushes prices down and makes everything accessible. Of course, that does not happen consistently in history, only in the fantasies of the neoliberals. By putting corporations firmly in the driver's seat, as Katherine Johnson of the American Friends Service Committee puts it, those investor-state dispute settlement mechanisms not only circumvent domestic policy, but they judge the value of all policies and institutions through the lens of investor profit. The problem is, our international and national laws and political structures often oppose this. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights holds that all human beings have the right to a minimum material standard of living, not just a standard of living profitable to investors. The UDHR also contains a provision that supporters of postal banking and post offices in general should note, Article 21, which guarantees access to public services, not just services profitable to investors. If there's a fight between the TPP's dispute settlement judges and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that's a fight I want to buy tickets for. I'm Matt Stannard, and it's our money and our public services.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.